So, and my clock says 9:30. So, I'd like to call this meeting to order. Ms. Bonkus, will you please do a roll call?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Davidson?
Here.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Here.
Dr. Raitz?
Here.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. Item number three, call to the public. Do we have anybody in person or on the phone who wishes to address the committee?
This is Kathy. Is Dr. Hancock on the phone or Ms. Hancock on the phone? Okay. I was expecting our universal recognition applicant to join the call. She may join later. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, no, we do not have anyone.
Okay. Thank you. Next item, item number four, approval of minutes for August 2nd, 2019. And I have a motion to approve.
I motion that we approve the minutes. This is Dr. Stenhoff.
Thank you. And a second?
I'll second.
Any discussion? All in favor of approving the August 2nd minutes? Say aye.
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 Opposed? And I am abstaining. I was not there. All right, item number five, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation to the board pertaining to approval of behavior analyst applicants. We have nine applicants. The first one is Alan Evans, and I will summarize her application. Ms. Evans attended Capella University, got a master's in psychology, and with an emphasis on applied behavior analysis. She accumulated 1,510 hours of supervised experience under three different supervisors and two different services. She became board certified on 5/31/2019. I did not note any concerns with this application, and I would recommend that it be forwarded to the board for approval. Are there any questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay, hearing none, let's move on to our second applicant. Application is from Ashley Hulkinson, Dr. Davies.
Yes. Sorry. Just as I decided to open that, I decided to just crash something. So give me 1 second. never a dull moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Miss Ashley. All right, she's back open. This application, as soon as it comes back up, it's now going to download some fonts, apparently. Okay, please bear with me. Here we go. Yes, so... sorry, folks, my computer is deciding to just be... not very fun. So yes, I have the application in front of me. I reviewed this application for licensure for the applicant. noting that she did her master's degree through Kuma State University. I worked through her master's in education there. She responded to all of our questions. She was able to obtain her certification working in California. And therefore, we have no licensure in California, and so that's something we need to deal with in terms of a licensed supervisor. I saw no issues with this application and would like to hear from my colleagues if they had any, if not, moving it forward.
Are there any other questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay, hearing none. Application number 3 for Brittany Cookman, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Yes, this is a request for additional information. It was our first request. It was related to an applicant that applied but indicated that she was working at the Phoenix location for CARD starting April of 2018 to current. She did provide us information stating that she did not separate her time in Virginia with her time for that specific position in Virginia with her time of when she was supposed to be in Arizona, and that all of her services were provided only in Virginia, and that she actually decided not to pursue employment with that company when she moved to Arizona and ultimately took on employment as a behavior technician with Dr. Bonet. She has provided us an updated application that indicates her role as behavior technician with Dr. Bonet since her move. And again, her letter clarifies that she has not provided services in Arizona, just Virginia. She stated that she listed the Phoenix address because that's where she was going to be going. And again, she didn't separate the position time, and she was in that position since April 2018. I found that the clarification made sense. The updated application was appreciated. It does sound like she has been serving in a role under direct supervision, under a licensed behavior analyst, and I would recommend that the application move forward.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay, hearing none. Our next application is from Carissa Gilliland. Dr. Rates, can you summarize, please?
Yes. So Carissa Gilliland received her master's in education from ASU in December of 2018. She received her supervision at CARD from Shane Olson, indicating 1,500 hours between June of 2018 and June of 2019. I did not note any concerns with this application and would recommend moving forward.
Thank you. Any concerns or questions from other committee members? Okay, hearing none. Our next application is from Gloria Gigliotti. Dr. Stenhouse, would you summarize, please?
Yes, Ms. Gigliotti graduated from Marywood University with an MS in special ed and received her Master's of Science concentration in applied behavior analysis at Kaplan University, now listed as Purdue University Global. Beginning in April of 2012 and completing in December of 2016. She received her supervision under three different supervisors and completed that. I didn't note any concerns with the application. I'd recommend that it move forward to the board for approval.
Thank you. Questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay, hearing none. The next application is from Melanie Marshall, and I will summarize that. Ms. Marshall graduated from University of West Florida with a master's in teaching education and leadership with an emphasis in applied behavior analysis. In total, she received, I do have a concern I want to point out to you. On her application form, the date of matriculation and the date of graduation are the same. So she listed 12/2018 as her start date for her graduate course program and 12/18 as her end date. I looked at her transcript, and her start date was actually 1/2018. End date was 12/2018. So we will need to ask her to correct that, I believe. She received 2,531 hours of supervised experience under two different supervisors, both in California. And the concern I had was that some of those supervision experiences started before she began her coursework. However, when I looked at her coursework, she had 3 credits from Brandon University or Brandon College that were in basic principles of behavior. And they were 3 graduate credits that were accepted by the University of West Florida as part of her master's, or a part of her ABA program. And those credits were taken between August of 2016 and December of 2016. So with that factored in, her supervised experience began after she started that first course at a different university, but those courses were accepted at University of West Florida. Does that make sense? Are you following me so far?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think that that's very interesting. This is the first we've seen of a university kind of accept those. I wonder if she was possibly a BCABA or on a BCABA track that allowed for that, but that's interesting, but it does make sense. Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm glad you could follow that. I don't know of any reason why we could not accept this. The concern I had was that she had started her experience before she started her coursework. But in fact, you know, looking at it from this angle, she did not. And that's the only concern I have with this application. So I would, you know, does anybody else have concerns about allowing this, you know, how these hours were accepted? I mean, I believe they must have been accepted by the BACB, but that's, in our statute, I don't know of anything that would prevent us from accepting and allowing the experience to be accepted under this situation. Does anybody have any concerns about that?
No? I do not.
Then I would recommend this application be forwarded to the board for approval. Thank you. The next application is from Melissa Harrison. Dr. Davy, would you summarize?
Mr. Chair, can I chime in on this one for just 1 second?
Yes, Dr. Davy, welcome.
Awesome. I have just a small disclaimer. I'm not sure why I was listed as the professional supervisor other than the position that I held with the company at the time that she did that 1 month rotation at our company, but Ms. Harrison was not directly supervised by me. She was directly supervised by other BCBAs that worked at the same organization that I did oversee the supervision program. However, she was not directly supervised by me during that month, and I wanted to just provide that clarification that I may have been listed as that professional supervisor for the workplace employment side of it and not her direct supervision.
Mr. Chairman, Understood. Dr. Davis-Wilson, are you talking about Dr. Marshall or Ms. Marshall or Ms. Harrison?
Oh, Ms. Harrison. Sorry, I thought we were on Ms. Harrison.
Okay, good. Thank you.
We are. Ms. Harrison.
Yeah, we are on Ms. Harrison right now.
Perfect. Perfect. Yes. Yeah. So that would be my disclaimer. I'm comfortable moving forward without a recusal because, like I said, other than just a couple of short conversations in the employment process side of things, I did not directly supervise her. She was with the location for a one-month rotation and was supervised by a different supervisor. I did not have any oversight or decision-making authority or anything on her supervision experience for that 1 month. That was handled by someone else. I'm just assuming that I was listed because I was the director of the organization at the time.
Thank you for that clarification. Dr. Davies?
Thank you very much. I really don't have any issues with the application for Ms. Harrison. I do just have a general question, and I think it's because I'm having a senior moment of not remembering how we're addressing something. But I'll walk us through the application. Ms. Harrison has applied for licensure in the state of Arizona. She attended Arizona State University. She had master hours within that program, getting supervised experience at Steak and at Walton Park, and then at Hope Group as well. Adam Haas has attested to her program being behavior analytic, and with no real issues with the applications, he's attested to the 1,500 hours. My question, I apologize for bringing this up, as I'm sure we've rehashed it multiple times, is in her application, she selected that Christina Bartel provided supervised experience towards certification and licensure, and that Tiffany Aniano as well provided supervised experience towards certification and licensure. Yeah, we have no, as well as Dr. Davis-Wilson, although we just heard that that's not completely correct. We have no information on those individuals and whether or not they were licensed in the state of Arizona at the time. We are, again, just taking Adam Haas's signature to attest to all of that. And so I just bring that back because when I was reviewing the application, it just kind of smacked me a little bit, and I just wanted to bring it back to the committee.
Mr. Chair,
I would
second Dr. Davies' concern on that, and the reason being is because, in addition to his concerns, I would state, you know, we are allowing the BACB forms, and had she opted to include those BACB forms, we probably would have done a license verification check. And under those circumstances, you would have seen who actually supervised under the supervision that she did at Hope Group. So I second Dr. Davies' concern in that, as far as I am aware, and I'm pretty familiar with the practicum program, and Dr. Stenhoff, you can chime in if you guys are changing how it's being done. But at this point, the practicum program has placed it on the site to determine the licensing status of the individual doing the supervision, and it's not something that's vetted or verified by the program itself. And so I second what Dr. Davy is saying, and I do believe that we talked about changing the application to reflect this in such a way that if they chose employment only, that wasn't a problem, but if they chose supervised experience toward certification, that we could still have board staff pull those licenses to verify the license. And I think in this particular case, where we're now identifying that my listing as a professional supervisor was probably not accurate to that form, pulling like a license, my license doesn't still necessarily verify that those hours for that 1 month was by a licensed behavior analyst. So I just wanted to chime in and agree with Dr. Davy on kind of where conversations we've had in the past regarding that.
It seems like a simple thing to have her correct that form on her application, would that be a sufficient resolution?
Mr. Chair, this is Brian.
Oh, go ahead.
So I think that correction step one, I'm just thinking also that we probably need to pull license verification for the individual that she's checked as providing supervision.
Which would be Christina Bartel at Peak and Tiffany and Nanio at Blossom Park, and then the correct supervisor for Hope Group. Is that correct? Those three?
Mr. Chair, yes, and I would clarify the supervisor that signed the hours towards the certification, because I, again, mm-hmm. I think that's where the confusion is the role and stuff versus who actually signed the supervision form.
That makes sense.
Mr. Chairman,
and I would just
members...
say that, yeah, board staff. Yeah, that's exactly right. We need to hear from board staff on how we can do that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my understanding, granted I haven't been with the board very long, but historically when we've received a verification from Dr. Haas, we have not been obtaining the license and BCBA certification information for the other supervisors listed, because he was the training director who was knowledgeable of the experience. If I'm happy going forward, if they list a different supervisor on this form, on this page 4 that we're looking at in the PDF, I'll be happy to get that information if that's your direction. But I just wanted to clarify that that is your direction going forward, even when we have a director of training doing the verification form.
That's a good point. Thank you. I think the form needs to be corrected, obviously, because Dr. Davis Wilson's name is there, and there should be somebody else's name. And I think that the correction that please correct this form to list the people who signed off on your verification forms. I think that that first step would be would be consistent with what we have done in the past when we have someone like Dr. Haas as the practicum supervisor overseeing all of this. Rather than having board staff look to see if those names are in fact licensed behavior analysts. That would be more consistent with what we've done in the past, because my recollection is similar to what Kathy just listed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I don't know that as the committee we can advocate our responsibility to ensure that the individuals providing supervision were licensed in the state. And I don't know that, I mean, essentially that would be giving the person that signed the 1,500-hour form, in this case, Dr. Haas of ASU, that responsibility then is foisted upon him. And I don't know that that's within the purview of the committee to allow that or to provide that to him.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I do believe that the argument of Dr. Haas signing the form was related to whether or not we needed multiple forms. We've all agreed that the one form still meets rule. However, we did also note in the past the concern, and I apologize that it didn't transition over to Kathy, but I'm with Dr. Davey that we were pretty concerned about the thought of Dr. Haas not being in any of the experience and us not being able to pull that, and that was what made us kind of lean towards having the separation of type of experience on the new application was, again, so that we could say, oh, this was supervised experience. We definitely need to do a licensure verification because unless ASU was to produce something for us that said, this is our process and blah, blah, blah. And even then, I mean, I think we still have to do kind of first party verification. I think that there were two kind of different arguments. So one argument was, well, if you list three different supervisors, you need three different forms. We agreed that Dr. Haas was knowledgeable enough in their 1,500 hours to be able to get it. However, we did at that time also note that Dr. Haas really didn't have any way to verify license or vet that piece. And so I think they're two different arguments and need a little bit of a modification still of pulling the license moving forward, the licensure status of whoever is listed in that experience.
That's a good point also. If can you think of any situation in the past where if we were to ask this applicant to correct this form and list the people who signed off on her experience verification forms and then ask our board staff to make sure they were licensed at the time of that supervision. Can anybody think of a situation in the past where we failed to do that? Would we be changing our precedent from that we had established in the past?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I could go back through applications because Dr. Haas signs off on verifications quite a bit, and I have not gone and obtained the license information based on the name of the supervisor on this page of the application. I could put a list together for you in the past year. I would be very happy to go forward from here and make sure that we do have that information, starting with these applications today, if you wanted to do a formal additional information, or even, yeah, because I'd have to get that information and get it to you.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Folks, I do have a question to that, though. It seems to me that this is a little bit administrative enough to not require a formal request for additional information unless they were not licensed. So, for example, if you were able to say, hey, we need to go ahead and change who actually signed your form on this, and if you edit that and were able to board staff able to verify that those people were licensed, then I don't see any reason why it can't go forward without coming back to us, because it is just a little bit administrative. I think the only reason why we would need it to come back to us would be that you find that one of them isn't or wasn't licensed, and then we would need a request for information for additional hours or what have you to cover those non-licensed. But I think if this is just administrative and we're just trying to make sure we have, you know, our ducks in a row in documentation and verification, I would be comfortable with it still going forward with the board staff just making those quick, the edit to the thing and checking the verifications and still pushing it to the full board.
I would be comfortable with that too.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd be happy to do that. I really appreciate the direction.
Well, thank you, Kathy. So it seems like a good strategy to take. It is our responsibility. And I'm just looking at the application right now to see if there's anything in there that might lead somebody to believe that they can list a supervisor that wasn't involved in their supervised experience applying toward licensure. The application seems fairly clear at the top of page six. So I guess I'm just thinking out loud. I don't I don't see any changes we would need to make in the application to prevent this from happening in the future. I don't know how Dr. Haas, what role he plays when they apply toward the BACB. I think that they would need to submit their supervision verification forms from their individual supervisors. Is that not true?
Mr. Chair, it has changed that it can be by site.
Mm-hmm. By site?
Yeah. So if you have like 4 supervisors from seat and 4 supervisors from card, you can
right.
submit a single verification from SEEK to the BACB and from CARD to the BACB. But it doesn't have, it used to be that it had to be, you had to submit 8 forms. Now mm-hmm. in that scenario, you would only have to submit 2 because it's by site.
Yeah. But a university coordinator of a program like ASU's would not suffice.
Mr. Chairman,
that was the only.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, this is Dr. Stenhoff. Yeah, that's correct. That is Dr. Davis Wilson indicated that that each site can have a verification form that encompasses all supervision or supervisors within that agency. Mm-hmm. But it's my understanding that Dr. Haas does not submit a form to the BACB regarding their supervision. It's within the state of Arizona for licensure.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So we have a recommendation to request that Ms. Harrison correct this page of her form. List the supervisors who signed off on her supervision verification forms, and board staff will in fact check to see if they were licensed at the time of that experience, and if they were, then we are recommending this application be forwarded to the board for approval. Is that an accurate summary?
Yes, sir.
Hearing nothing, then I either confused everybody or it's okay. All right. Kathy, do you have any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I do not. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
And all right. Mr. Chair, real quick, I wanted to circle back to Dr. Davey. It sounds like Dr. Davey's okay with moving forward. And just as kind of a point of kind of process, if it were to go to the full board on Friday, and by chance there was still something in overlap, just so the committee's aware, Dr. Davey and I would be able to catch that and remove that from the consent agenda. So I just, I wasn't sure if everybody was kind of aware of what that process looks like. But I think it's important to kind of help us speed up some of these applications that are administrative in nature, because we still have the ability to kind of instruct the board staff, but there's still that kind of gap of Dr. Davey and I would be able to double check before it actually goes through.
Thank you. That is helpful. Okay. Applicant number 8, Meredith Molina. Dr. Reitz, can you summarize, please?
Yes. So Ms. Molina completed her master's in education from ASU in December of 2018, and she received supervision under Dr. Huff at AZA, the charter school, between January 2018 and February 2019, for a total of 1,519 hours. I did not note any issues of concern for this application and recommend that it be moved forward.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Hearing none. The next and final applicant is Sarah Gilbert, Dr. Stenhoff. Please summarize.
Yeah, Ms. Gilbert graduated from Boston University with an MED in special ed and her ABA coursework at Caldwell University beginning in September of 2013 and attended until May of 2015. She received her supervision hours under Kelly DeRosa, and I didn't note any concerns with this application. I'd recommend that it move forward to the board for approval.
Thank you. Any concerns or questions from other committee members? Hearing none. Okay, can I have a motion to forward these applications to the board?
So moved.
And a second?
I second.
Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Next item is item B of number 5, which is the BHRAM application for licensure by universal recognition. We have one application, Melissa Hancock, Dr. Davis Wilson. Will you summarize for us?
Absolutely. So this is our first universal recognition application. And so basically what we are instructed to do is to verify mostly two pieces of information, a third to make sure that there's not any pending convictions, prior convictions, those sorts of things. But the first task we have is to look to ensure that the individual has been licensed by the state they're currently practicing in for a period or another state for a period of 1 year. And the second piece is that we have verified residency. So for Ms. Hancock, I have just one small note on the application itself that Oklahoma on the first page is misspelled. There's a typo. Not a huge deal, but she may want the option to correct it, being that it is public record and it is a professional status. I don't know. It's not that big of a deal. You can see what it says. But then the license has been the licensee has been a licensee of Oklahoma since April of 2017. This has been verified by the board, so you can see the verification of licensure there. And she has provided us two pieces of residency, one being the utilities bill, the second being the lease document. Based on that information and the completion of the application, I have no concerns with this application, and I would refer it for the full board.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from other committee members?
This is Dr. Dean, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Is it my understanding that Ms. Galvin is present today?
I am.
Believe me.
Ms. Galvin, I think this is the first one of these that we've experienced, and I recognize that we are still perhaps waiting for some guidance from the state around the universal recognition, particularly as it pertains to what is residency. Do we have the information to move this forward at this point?
There was a memo from the Attorney General's office that was provided to the board and I believe to the committee. Is that right, Kathy? Yes, it was provided to the committee. And the board has adopted a substantive policy statement that explains that when proving or trying to demonstrate that an applicant has established a residence in Arizona, there's a number of documents that the board would look to and consider when it is making that determination whether a residence has been established. And a utility bill and a lease were on the list of approved documents. To my understanding, the substantive policy statement has been posted to the board's website.
And the There's no discussion of duration within that document. Am I correct?
There is not, because the statute does not dictate a duration of time.
So, and that would be where my question was going, is the lease agreement executed on July 15th. That puts this individual in town for July to August, a month, you know, it'd be almost 2 months by the time this goes to the full board. And so that was really kind of the question I had is, has residency been established at a 45-day period? And it sounds like you're saying, based on the information we have from the AG, the answer is yes.
Which is based on our interpretation of the statute.
I appreciate you clarifying. Thank you.
No problem.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, because this was reviewed in the last board meeting, the board staff has done a really good job about getting recordings of those board meetings. So if the committee, I know Dr. Davey was unable to make that meeting, but if you guys as a committee ever want to kind of hear a decision that's made on something that's going to affect the committee, you can go in and actually watch or listen to the board meeting. And I think that it's important, like in a case like this, because to Dr. Davey's point, there was definite discussion around, so someone could live here for a week, and essentially that still meets the ability, or what if they're only staying here for 6 months and they've identified that. There was kind of discussion around that establishment of residency, and I bring that up because, Dr. Davey, you were not the only one that was kind of like, well, what if they are only here for 2 months, or they just got here yesterday, like, or they're not quite here yet, those sorts of things of, like, so long as they have that proof of the documentation, the general consensus was that the governor likely pushed forward the statute as a means of getting, you know, kind of promoting people being able to easily work here. So the length of time they've lived here, the length of time they're going to live here, wasn't necessarily a consideration. It was more of that residency. But it was a really good discussion, so I encourage you guys as a committee to go and listen to the recording, because there was perspectives brought up of, like, how residency is established at the college level and yada, yada, yada. And so it's just a good discussion, so I just wanted to make you guys aware of that resource as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, excuse me, this is Kathy. On the committee materials site, if you look under Behavior Analyst Statutes and Rules, you will find the policy. It's the last one listed. It's SP.08_19, Residence Determination for Universal Recognition Application. And that is the policy that the board adopted at the last board meeting. Also, I had a question for you. On this particular application, the applicant also submitted a change of address order with USPS. This would be listed, let me pull this up again, in the policy on page 2 under the objective evidence. It states documentation demonstrating a change in permanent address on all pertinent records, and for staff direction, I was hoping for direction, is a change of address from USPS in and of itself sufficient evidence? Would you, if that had been the only evidence in the application, going forward, I had questioned it, and I had actually asked Ms. Hancock to send additional information because that was the only one. And so I was hoping to ask for direction for the future, since this is so brand new.
Sure, that's a good question. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and yes. Board staff, and maybe Ms. Galvin, you can chime in. My interpretation of what the last board meeting, what as a board we voted on, was that we would only use the listed kind of documents that were available. I would prefer to see additional information, as I could be wrong, but I don't know for myself that I would count that as like established residency. I like the list that's provided to us already in the policy. So if it's in there, then that's cut and dry. If it's not, then I agree with requesting additional information. But that would be my question maybe to Ms. Galvin is, was that list intended to be all-inclusive, or was there room for us as a committee to wiggle around some options?
The list was not intended to be all-inclusive because there will be examples where someone will provide documentation that, you know, we did not think of. You are free to add to the list, but, you know, with a change of address, you could add it to your list, but also think that, you know, there's something maybe perhaps more substantive that you would require.
Again, this is Kathy. The change of address, change in permanent address actually is on the list. What I was wondering was, is just the one change of address with USPS, does that meet this statement in the policy, quote, documentation demonstrating a change in permanent address on all pertinent records, unquote?
Yeah, that would be could be a lot of documentation, couldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that would be a change in address, a mailing address. I don't believe that meets that bullet of documentation demonstrating a change in permanent address on all pertinent records.
Thank you.
Right.
That's my opinion. Other committee members?
And Mr. Chair, that was kind of the direction that I was going as well. As I don't know that a U.S. post proof of address change, because I can change my address pretty easily without any documentation, whether I live in state or out of state. And I can also go to like a P.O. box or something of that sort. So I would agree that the additional information would still be needed there. I also, Mr. Chair, I also could change the address to like my parents' address, but not reside there or have proof of.
Right. Or your multiple second homes.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. That's a joke. I'm sorry.
Her trailer in Heber.
I know. All of my motor homes are registered in the state of Arizona. Would that count? My boat? I do have a boat. I have two of them registered in the state of Arizona. Does that count as establishing residency?
I hope not.
So in this applicant situation, he still provided the APS, the lease package, as well as the USPS. So we have two other forms or two other pieces of evidence that she is residing in Arizona. But the question that Kathy asked is a good one, and I would tend to agree that it does not, the USPS does not meet that bullet.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much for that direction so that I know how to handle it going forward. I appreciate it.
Any other questions or concerns about this universal licensure by universal recognition?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Dr. Davis-Wilson, in one of her statements, brought up the point of or mentioned about a P.O. box. And, you know, while they may have multiple examples, I think we may need to question whether a P.O. box is an adequate proof of residence as well in the future.
Yeah, and would that relate to that second to last bullet, the one that we were discussing before?
It would.
Okay. if the P.O. box was changed for all pertinent records, it might be a little more compelling.
Sure.
And, Mr. Chair, you know, the one that's unique and kind of interesting is that now you can get P.O. boxes with actual addresses. They usually, they're numbered a little bit different, but you can get, and businesses will do it too, you can get boxes that have the actual address of the post office, so it appears like you have an address. But so it's not just the, like, P.O. box ones would be easy for us to say, hey, that really you can get a P.O. box and, you know, wherever, but the interesting one is when they kind of look like addresses as well.
Mm. Hello, this is Melissa Hancock. I'm on the phone with you guys. I was wondering if proof of employment in the state of Arizona would be beneficial for proving residency.
Mr. Chair, I can go ahead and answer that. That would not, as it could theoretically be that you live out of state and are employed in Arizona, you'd still need to be licensed. But if you go to the board website, and board staff can actually email you a copy of the document as well if you haven't seen it yet. But there's a pretty established kind of guideline of documentation that that they'll accept to really show residency, because in theory, you don't have to be a resident in Arizona to work in Arizona. But that's a great question, and I appreciate, one, you joining us. Thank you. And sorry we didn't catch it, that you had chimed in. But thank you for that. And then, two, this is kind of like, I think we're, you know, kind of because you are the very first application that we've seen of this type, we're kind of having some discussion we wouldn't typically have on applications. So we appreciate you being patient and hearing us out as well.
Yes, of course.
Are there any other concerns? Or does this applicant have, has she supplied all that's needed for licensure by universal recognition?
Mr. Chair, I would say yes. And I do recommend it to be forwarded to, I'll make a motion on it. I motion that we forward this to the full board.
Approval?
All right.
I will second.
Just to clarify,
the motion.
Dr. Davis-Wilson, that motion was forwarded to the full board for approval, correct?
Correct, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. And we do have a second?
Yes, Brian.
Okay, that's what I thought. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. And thank you for joining us, Ms. Hancock.
Thank you.
Okay. The next item, item number six, and this is new for us too, so I'm going to provide an introduction. Item number six is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding continuing education audit. We, under R-426-409, in a two-year licensing period, behavior analysts must complete 30 CEUs with four of the 30 credits in ethics. All continuing education credits must meet the requirements of R-426-409. The licensing period being audited at this time was the prorated period from May 1st, 2017 to April 30th, 2019, as licensees were transitioned to the individual renewal cycle based on the birth month of the licensee and the license number. Therefore, the CE requirement was individually prorated. The board issued substantive policy statement SD0216 regarding the prorated license period. This policy allows licensees during the transition period only to apply up to 10 CEUs earned above and beyond the 30 CE credit required for the previous license period of May 1, 2015 through April 30, 2017. The CE audit for the prorated license period takes into account the board's substantive policy statement regarding carryover up to 10 CEUs. If a licensee applied carryover CEs, the Committee on Behavior Analysts may request evidence of CE applied to the previous license period, May 1, 2015 to April 30, 2017, from which CE is being carried over. In order to determine that the CE being carried over was earned above and beyond the requirement for the previous licensing period. If the committee determines that a licensee meets the requirements, the committee will forward the agenda item to the board for approval. If the committee determines that a licensee is deficient in continuing education requirements, the licensee may be given up to 90 days from the date of deficiency letter to complete additional continuing education, provide additional information, and if necessary, complete the affidavit of cure. The committee may also recommend to forward the agenda item to the board for additional review and possible action. Dr. Davis Wilson, you have the first CE audit on the agenda for Ashley Bennett.
So I've reviewed the CE sent in by Ashley Bennett. The CE for Ashley Bennett does meet the requirements, and I recommend approval for her CE.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Hearing none. The next licensee is Paige Breeden. Dr. Davy? Are you muted, Dr. Davy?
Yes, and I just had such an eloquent summary for you that you missed it. Apparently, I did not get to share it with you. So, I have reviewed the CEs sent in by Paige, and the documentation was included to confirm that the CE submitted yet met the requirements.
Okay.
Needs to require, and I recommend approval. Sorry, I was reading skimming the script, and I forgot I recommended approval.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Hearing none. The next licensee is Daniel Bulara. Dr. Rakes?
Yes. So I do have a question for this individual. Daniel submitted the CEUs and required 6.25 total with one in ethics. In reviewing the CEUs that were submitted, only four of the CEUs occurred before the expiration date of 2/29/18. Daniel did submit additional CEUs that occurred after that expiration date, which would meet the requirements, but I was unsure if that was acceptable towards this period of time.
According to the intro that I shared with you.
Yep.
A licensee, we could allow a licensee to submit additional. But this person did it on his own.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for board staff, maybe Ms. Galvin. So two things. One, if we were to say yes, we will accept these, is there also a way to send a letter or additional information to say, like, hey, you really need to have these on time and you kind of got this? Or do we not accept them, given that 90 days, and say, hey, we'll go ahead and accept this, just so that there's some sort of contingency that you know, kind of prevents it from possibly happening again in the future? That's part number one. The second part is, if we do accept these, can they also be counted toward the current certification cycle, or should we all inform him that they cannot? I'm not sure which way that would go either.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, in looking at this, my understanding you can accept CE that was completed either during the license period, the prorated period, and in this case that would be May 1st, 2017 through the expiration date, through February 29th, 2018, actually, it should be 28th, isn't it? Was the 2018 a leap year? Anyway, 2/29/2018 is what's listed here. Or some CE that's carryover from the previous license period. You should not be applying CE from the current license period backwards without a formal deficiency letter being sent to them and then them sending the additional.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Folk, so I'm correct in an understanding. I just want to recite that back to you as it pertains to this one, that essentially our options would be to still say, nope, this didn't meet the requirements, and give them 90 days to provide us additional that does meet the requirements. So my question still would lie then, if he chooses to say, why did these in February and March of 18 and 19 or what have you, that we would be able to say, okay, we'll accept those toward this, or would it be best to say you need to complete this many CEs between now and then and not accept those back ones that were not previously approved by the board, so that we don't run into an issue of them double counting for certification or for licensure renewals?
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Davis-Wilson, one thing about this person in particular, they only needed to do 6.25 CEs. Four, from what you've said, are acceptable. The ethics ones that he did in November of 2017. So he only needs 2.25 more CEs to meet the requirements. What I believe normally would take place is, in the deficiency letter, you would ask them to either send in the 2.25 additional or from the audited period or the carryover, or you would they could then complete additional CE. I don't know. We'd have to ask Jean if they can use the CE they submitted already, but we would only count 2.25. They could then use all the rest of the CE for their renewal next time.
To avoid that double dipping that you referred to.
Perfect. Mr. Chair, that makes sense to me.
Okay. So we will send him a letter to that effect. And we will... And can we include in the letter, if I understood you correctly, can we include in the letter a reminder that if he needs to complete additional CEs, that they not be counted toward next year's renewal?
That's a standard in these letters, yes. Thank you.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you very much. Any other concerns about this application? Thanks for catching that, Dr. Wade.
Of course.
Licensee number four, we did not receive the information from that person, correct? Craig said?
Correct. Sorry. We did not receive his CE. He will be sent a letter. I've already tried to reach out to him, but I've not heard a response. We will be sending him another letter, letting him know that he is late getting his CE in.
All right. Thank you. And do we have any responsibility? Do we have any, what do we do with somebody who is late?
If he doesn't respond to the follow-up letter, then we'll bring it back to the board, and you could open a complaint for failing to comply with the CE requirements.
Okay, thank you. Licensee number five, Paul Davis. Dr. Rakes, you again.
Yeah. So I have reviewed the CE sent in by Paul Davis, and this CE sent in did meet the requirements. So I would recommend that we move this forward for approval.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from our committee members? Hearing none. Licensee number six, Catherine Hurd. Dr. Davis Wilson.
Yes, I've reviewed the CE sent in by Catherine Hurd. The CE for Ms. Hurd does meet the requirements, and I recommend approval.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns about this licensee? Hearing none. Licensee number seven, Jill Hagland. Dr. Davy.
I've reviewed the CE sent in by Jill Hagland. And the documentation does meet the requirements, and I recommend approval.
Thank you. Questions or concerns from other committee members? Next, licensee, Aaron Juarez, Dr. Stenhouse. Are you muted, Dr. Stenhouse?
I am, in fact, muted, Dr. Davidson. Let's see, I've reviewed the CEs sent in by Ms. Juarez. The CEs for her meet the requirements, and I recommend approval.
Thank you. Questions or concerns from other committee members? All right. Licensee number eight, Kyle Leninger. Dr. Rich?
I would like to just note that I am recused from Kyle Leininger. I'm also recused from number 12, Jesse Marshall, 16, Mary Stevenson, and 17, Sasha Verdugo.
I, too, am recused from Kyle Leininger. We still have...
Yep. Can I get clarification from board staff of whether or not we need to list the people that recuse? Is that something we need to do as part of this?
Typically, yes.
To promote the individuals that...
Yes. Okay.
We probably should have called for those early on.
Do you want to just state on the record now those that you are recused from?
Dr. Davey, I'll state that I recused myself from Ashley Bennett.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other recusals? Okay. Dr. Rakes?
Yes. So I did review the CE sent in by, Kyle Leininger. In reviewing those CEs, Kyle met the requirement, and I would recommend that we move forward with approval.
Thank you. Questions or concerns from other board members? Committee members? Hearing none. Licensee number 10, Adrian Litwiller. I reviewed the CE sent in by Ms. Litwiller. Do you meet the CE requirements? and I recommend her to be forwarded to the board for approval. Any questions or concerns about Adrian Littler's CEs? Next, we have applicant Melissa Mallon, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Oh, sorry. I just moved my form. Give me 1 second. Nope, I don't know where my little agenda went. All right. So I reviewed the CEs for Melissa Mallon. The CE for Ms. Mallon does meet the requirements, and I do recommend approval.
Thank you. Questions or concerns from other committee members? Hearing none. The next licensee is Jessica Marshall. I reviewed the CE sent in by Jessica Marshall. The CE for Ms. Marshall meets the requirements, and I recommend approval. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Hearing none. The next applicant is Deborah Mulder, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Yes, I reviewed the CE documents for Deborah Mulder, and Deborah Mulder did meet the requirements, and I do recommend approval.
Thank you. Questions or concerns from other committee members? Hearing none. The next licensee is Francesca Randall, Dr. Ray.
Yes, I reviewed the CEUs sent in by Ms. Randall, and the CEUs did meet the requirements, so I would recommend moving forward for approval.
Thank you. Questions or concerns from other committee members? Hearing none. The next licensee is Katie Sears, Dr. Spinner.
Okay. So I reviewed the CEs, and the CEs for Ms. Sears meet the requirements, and I recommend approval.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from committee members? Hearing none. Our next licensee is Mary Stevenson. Dr. Davies?
Yes, I reviewed the CEs sent in by Ms. Stevenson. They meet the requirements, and I recommend approval.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns by committee members? Hearing none. Our next licensee is Sasha Verdugo, Dr. Stenhoff.
Yeah, I reviewed the fee sent in by Ms. Verdugo, and they met the requirements, and I recommend for approval.
Thank you. Questions or concerns from other committee members? Hearing none. Next licensee is Kathleen Walsh. Dr. Stenhoff, it's you again.
Yeah, again, reviewed the fees for Ms. Walsh. They met the requirements, and I recommend them for board approval.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Lastly, we have Terry Wright. I reviewed the CE sent in by Ms. Wright. The CE from Ms. Wright meets the requirement, and I recommend approval. Are there concerns or questions from other committee members? Hearing none, that concludes our discussion on continuing education audit. So I presume we need a motion to forward these licensees to use to the board for full approval. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
So
it would be forwarding to the board for approval, and it would go on the consent agenda.
Okay.
This is Dr. Davies, and I so move.
Dr. Stenhoff, I second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you. Item number 7, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding BACD supervisor training requirements. Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Yes. So, Mr. Chair, last meeting we had a discussion around the dates required for the supervisory training, and Dr. Davy and the committee did recommend that the board do additional research related to the BACB's official start date of when that was required. Ms. Folks was doing due diligence on that. However, because I did work on the rule writing, I actually had a folder of documents that were already prepared from the rule writing that I went ahead and shared multiple newsletters and pieces of information that do show that the effective date by the BACB was January 1st, 2015. From January 1st, 2015 on, all supervisors are required to have the 8-hour supervisory curriculum and the orientation to supervision by the BACB and be listed on the BACB as a meets requirement supervisor. And so that point of clarification really was to just make sure that the board was satisfied with the amount of information we were able to gather just from the BACB. Like I said, a lot of that came from the work that we did in their original rule writing, and that the supervisor piece did remain in the rule. The piece that we removed out of the rule was the supervisee registration, because that training that was listed there is no longer required, or is currently, I should say, not required by the BACB. So there isn't even an option for supervisees to do it. So we were able to kind of remove that out of the rule package before the 12/12/2018 rules went into effect. But the supervisory piece stayed, and the date that we were able to come up with through multiple avenues of documentation from the BACB website, including, you know, if you guys are obviously familiar with the newsletters, when they do big changes like that, they usually spend a year or two doing kind of a pre-timeline, and then once the change happens, they have several months where they're like, as a reminder, this changed, as a reminder. So using all that documentation, that was the date that we came to. I don't know if Ms. Folks has anything else to add, but we did want to make sure that the board was comfortable with us going that route, because I do believe the direction was to reach out to the BACB. The only concern that I presented with that is that the BACB is doing a lot of, have you checked our website, have you checked our website? So we went ahead and did due diligence on the website first.
Mr. Chairman, this is Kathy. Dr. Davis-Wilson did provide things. I had written a memo, and it did not get uploaded to the case, to the agenda. It's not there. If you would like, I will be happy to run upstairs and go upload that. If everyone would refresh in about 10 minutes, it'll be there for you to review. I apologize that it did not get uploaded.
You're not the first one to have some technology challenges.
I'll just chime in that after the discussion, Mr. Chair, I also went back to the newsletters and did find that date. The thing I will just point out is the issue of seeing people that were eligible to be able to have essentially met the requirements, they were allowed in the run-up to that date. So the date that we are discussing is January 1st of 2015. At that time, was when that requirement hit in effect. So you have people that were actually hitting that requirement, in 2014 and maybe as far back as 2013. And so there was that run-up period, and that's the reason we don't see consistent dates of like, hey, supervision for this individual was validated on the effective date of the BACB. It was actually validated on the effective date of the individual achieving those accomplishments, even if they predated the requirement. So I think, you know, someplace in our, like, you know, book of knowledge for the board, for this committee, it's probably important to note that for future board members or for future committee members, just to have that kind of information. I think, you know, these are the things that we come across these first 2 years that no doubt will save board staff time if there's kind of an FAQs developed around these this kind of information. So I appreciate everyone's efforts, Diana. Thank you. And my board staff, I appreciate it as well.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first is for Dr. Davis Wilson. You listed three things that the supervisor is required: the 8-hour training curriculum to be listed on the BACB as a supervisor. What was the other item?
Mr. Chair, there is also an orientation to supervision, the supervision curriculum, which is a supervisor outline that the BACB has, and that's actually done in the portal. So when you log into your BACB portal, you go over to the tab for supervisor qualifications, and when you click on it, it has kind of what you need to be qualified, and if you're already qualified, your approval and your approval date. The what you need to be qualified is the 8-hour supervision, where you can upload your certificate for those 8 hours. The second piece is an orientation to their supervisor curriculum outline, and it talks mm-hmm. about some of the hour allocation. I would venture to say that we may see a little gap in that, but we wouldn't see it on our end because the BACB will probably still approve. And the reason why I say that is because the standards are changing. If the BACB changes their little orientation before the standards change, then there wouldn't be a gap. But let's say you're employing a new BCBA and they go in and they say, hey, I only have one thing. That's probably because that orientation that they have is going to have to be updated because it covers the supervision curriculum that was in place from 2004, the supervision curriculum outline that was in place from 2014 until November of this year, I think. And then there's a new supervision curriculum outline that goes into effect, and then new hour allocations for 2022. So I'm guessing that they're going to be working on updating that second one, but it's essentially just a BACB orientation module. You complete both of those, and then the BACB will assign you an approval date for when you can meet the requirements to be a supervisor, and then that's posted immediately on the website.
And as part of that approval from the BACB is keeping up our supervision CEs as well?
Correct. And so when they do the CE review, so you don't have to submit anything further into that as of right now. When they do the CE review, you do have to acknowledge that you did three CEs, and obviously in an audit, you'd have to prove that. But then they double check that if you didn't do the supervisor CEs, but you are listed as a meet the supervisor, then they will send you a deficiency. But you don't have to upload those supervisor CEs in a different portal. Because the BACB is trying to work on a way that the ACE provider, so the people in charge of the CEs, would be able to connect with the BACB portal automatically. So instead of me sending you a certificate and you having to upload it, and then if there's any discrepancy, they have to send it to me. Or because, like myself, I'm an ACE provider, I have to also send my rosters in. So there's some duplication of you sending in, you attesting to your certificate. I'm also sending in my paper rosters. And so they're trying to figure out a way for the ACE providers to be able to communicate directly into the system. And so I don't see them moving that supervisor CE piece out because it would add another step. So that's okay. The process right now is it's processed in your renewal as a supervisor, and they'll catch it when they review and approve your CEs.
Okay. My second question is for the group, but mostly for board staff, and that is, does any of this information have any implications for how you do your checks on a licensee who is supervising someone?
Committee members, this is Jean Galvin. Unfortunately, Kathy has stepped away for a minute, and she would be able to answer that question more effectively than Jennifer or I, and we apologize.
That's okay. She ran upstairs. I forgot about that. If I recall correctly.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Oh, I was going to say that in the previous meetings, since about February, we've been working with Ms. Folk to be able to pull the supervisor status on the BACB and provide that to us so that we can guarantee that they were an approved supervisor prior to the start date of the supervision. And so, and that's going to be extremely important because if you guys recall in 2022, brand new supervisees or brand new BCBAs will not be allowed to supervise in accordance with the board, not our rules or statutes at this point, but they will not be allowed to supervise towards certification for 1 year. And so it'll be very important at that time that we're checking those dates because we don't want people supervising during that year and then not being eligible for licensure. So I believe Ms. Folks has already has that in her process. She was very, very kind and okay with adding that to her process at the time that we requested it. And so I think that that's pretty much the only additional step that we had put into place back in like February-ish. And she's been okay with it as far as what's been communicated so far.
Excellent. Thank you. That's what I wanted to know. And I do remember seeing proof of that. Here's somebody who's been a BCBA for so long and is also registered as a supervisor. Okay. Any further discussion on this item about the supervisor training requirement? Thank you very much for your research and summary of this, Dr. Davis Wilson. Next item is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding request for reinstatement of license from Siri Ming. Dr. Reese.
Yes, so we did receive the request for reinstatement from Ms. Ming in reviewing the required continuing ed. She did, in fact, meet the requirements for that, and I would recommend that we move forward.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Hearing none. So we have a recommendation for reinstatement. I believe we probably will need a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would motion to move this reinstatement to the full board for approval.
Thank you.
I will second that.
Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is Kathy. If you want to refresh your screen, if you're using the online committee materials site, I have uploaded the supervisor requirements documentation so that you can see it. It's listed at the bottom of the agenda items. BACB supervisor requirements is what it's called.
Got it. And Kathy, may I say, I love this new system. it's so easy to find the different forms that we need to reference and our applications, and I just really appreciate it. Thank you. So, item number 9. Discussion, consideration, possible action pertaining to rule changes for behavior analysts, including but not limited to education requirements, supervised experience documentation requirements, and ethical standards. Ms. Michelson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you. Ms. Fox did upload a memo regarding this a couple days ago. As noted in the memo, last month, Ms. Jones had submitted a request to the governor's office for an exemption from the rulemaking moratorium. She included an outline with the proposed changes in there. She was subsequently notified from the governor's office that the protocol had changed and that they required the actual proposed rule changes to be sent in order for the approval to be granted. And speaking with our rules writer, Ms. Hahn, she indicated for the behavior analyst rules that there were a couple different areas that we needed the committee to discuss and decide on before moving forward with that.
Thank you. I'm looking at the memo now. Does everybody have a the memo dated September 4th? From Kathy regarding rules writing needs direction.
Mr. Chair, I do have some comments when everybody's ready.
All right, can we go in order? Page one, the education requirement?
Yes. So Mr. Chair, these were ones that we had already gone over in previous meetings, probably May-ish, and had already approved for Ms. Jones to send over. And so we've already kind of put that in the rule package. My question, I guess, for board staff is, there are additional changes that I think need to be made. Can we make those ahead of time before going? And then my second part of that question is, there were some things that at the time we opted to not tackle in the rule writing portion, or in this section right now, because this was all based on the rule review. So my second part of the question is, are we going to be able to, if we send this packet over, are we only limited to these items? Are we going to be in a position where we can write rule, or is that null and void because we are in a potential position of needing to review some statutory changes? Do we have to go through the statutory change first and then visit rule writing, but do this on the side to make sure that we have corrections, if that makes sense? I guess that was like three different questions.
This is Jean Galvin. My understanding is that these are our draft rules. We're looking for a blessing from you and then the board so we can send them over to the governor's office to get approval for the exemption. So I would recommend that if there are additional changes or different additional topics that you want to tackle, that we do that now in this one rule package instead of opening up another rule package that, you know, in the same chapter. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Unless there's something
so Mr.
Unless there's something in this rule package that has to get adopted and implemented quickly because of timelines, I would suggest you keep everything in one rule package.
Okay. So that makes sense. So, Mr. Chair, if I may, I would just like to then clarify that I have a couple of edits to what's currently here. The other things that I project needing to be changed, because of the way it's defined in statute, such as the practicum experience, supervised field work experience, those sorts of things, we would have to change it in statute first and then rule, because those definitions are in statute and they're being changed by the BACB. But we'd have to, that would be a whole separate process. From what I'm hearing from you, Ms. Galvin, even though we want to include as much as we can in the rule package, the changes that I'm referring to are rules that actually do tie to statute, that we would need statutes first. So the only change that I would recommend in this first section, Dr. Davidson, is that it does say BACB approved. As of January 1st, it's no longer the BACB approval, or is it this year? Anyway, it's no longer BACB, and there's a different verified course sequence approval process, so I think we need to change that language.
So, bottom of page two, is that related to this, a degree program in which the applicant completed a BACD-approved course sequence?
Correct. And then the revision is a degree program in which the applicant completed a BACD-approved program, but the BACD
right.
is no longer approving programs.
And is it a course sequence, approved course sequence, or a verified course sequence now?
It is now a verified course sequence. You know what, Dr. Senhoff, maybe since you're probably in the mix of all of it, maybe you have some guidance for us on this. Is Dr. Senhoff muted by chance?
That's a good question. Dr. Senhoff, are you there?
All right. Mr. Chair, I will chime in. You are correct. It is a verified course sequence. Universities right now are working on changing the process to become approved verified course sequences. There are a couple of additional requirements for universities that were not done by the BACD, and that's specific that they not only verify the sequence, but they do also verify the qualifications of each instructor, which is kind of nice. And then the BACD kind of approved like a general, did you meet these hours by report? And the verified course sequence is now looking at syllabi and making sure that there's very distinct approvals prior to the implementation of coursework. So the verified course sequence seems to be a lot more rigorous. But nonetheless, I just don't want the confusion of the BACD approved when it is actually a verified course sequence to get confusing, and I would propose we just change that language to verified course sequence.
So a degree program in which the applicant completed a verified course sequence? I'm looking at the number two under at the bottom of page two of the memo.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, when you read it out loud, I automatically just thought, because yes, you're on the right spot and on the right track of what I was suggesting, but when you read it out loud, as it would stand, I think that might still cause confusion. So let me brainstorm. Let me brainstorm a little bit of verbiage there, but we definitely
sure.
need BACD approved removed. So if anybody has suggestions on good verbiage there.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is Kathy. Just before you get further, a degree is the verified course sequence a BACB verified course sequence or just a verified course sequence?
It has been a BACB. In the past, it has been a BACB approved course sequence. And now it's ABAI, verified course sequence?
Yes, it's ABAI, Mr. Chair.
So, but the problem is listing, we have applicants who will submit coursework under the BACD approved, and then we'll have applicants submitting coursework under the verified.
Yeah. So this is Dr. Davey. I would just think that maybe we can get some guidance on this, that for the time being, we will likely need to accept both. We'll need to be able to accept individuals as they kind of graduate out of the BACB verified sequence, and then as essentially individuals will start then applying with the ABAI sequence. And so we may just have to list both for the time being and see if that gets us through that. Because if we only list the one, then we're going to put ourselves at risk of not being able to accept those that essentially came before the ABAI side of it. And I'm fearful of, say, people that are moving from different states that are not newly certified
that you know, have their BCBA from 2013. They are going to go through the verified course sequence by the BACB and not ABAIs. And so we may need to think about having them both there.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, I think that's a very good point. One question that I have, and maybe we need to reach out to the BACB on this, is that the BACB currently lists approved kind of programs. My question is, are they going to continue to provide that information as an approved program? And if so, then maybe the verbiage doesn't need to change. Because even though ABAI might be verifying the course sequence, that almost seems like a back-end process of how to become an approved program. Or are they going to reference it back to the ABAI? Because I think similar to maybe a direction Dan was going with the concern is that by adding ABAI verified sequence, we don't have ABAI defined, and then we have an issue with a whole other entity being involved that isn't really defined anywhere else. I think that that could also become problematic. So I wonder if the BACB is going to continue to have their list of university programs, and if so, if that would be enough for us to say, look, maybe they're outsourcing how they approve the programs, but the programs are still there, what they're willing to accept as approved programs for certification, if that makes sense.
So what is
It very well might, Diana, in that from what I'm reading, you know, and I'm just kind of looking at the language upon ABAI and the BACB website, it does appear that the BACB still kind of holds the card in some of that. So maybe we can we can defer to that language. It does make it sound like regardless of the BCS, that course sequence has to meet the eligibility for option one of the BACB. Certification. So it seems like they did hold, they still hold the cards and would have to hit all those requirements regardless of the ABAI or anybody else that is going to be doing the verification part of it.
Yeah. I feel like that sounds a lot like what I'm reading as well, Dr. Davey, and so I wonder if the BACB approved program is the best way to address both concerns. Again, my only concern would be, and I guess we can address it when it comes up, would be if the BACB said our approved programs are click here, and all of a sudden they're approved by a whole outside entity without any, like, the BACB having any play in it, then I think that could become problematic. But maybe the language as is the best suited for now.
Even though it says BACB approved.
Mr. Chair, because I think at this point there's still so it's almost like looking at college accreditation, right? Like we're not there. Well, I guess if we put it that way, then yeah, there are lists of acceptable accrediting college bodies too. So that's the hard part on this is that the BACB is accepting the recommendation of the verified course sequence, but the verified course sequence is not an accreditation process, and so it's a little bit different. But essentially, they're outsourcing the manpower, technology overview. You know what? Actually, Mr. Chair, why don't we ask the board staff? Doesn't psychology have this same thing with regard to an APA-approved program?
Yes, I believe so.
But the APA does not certify psychologists, correct? They're just a professional association.
This is Kathy, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Davis-Wilson. Under 32-2071, an applicant for licensure shall have a doctoral degree from an institution of higher education, and then it defines the type of applied psychology, and then shall have completed a doctoral program in psychology from an educational institution, that has been accredited by one of the following regional accrediting agencies at the time of the applicant's graduation. And then it lists, I think, six different regional accrediting bodies. And so the doctoral, there's also the opportunity for the doctoral program to be APA accredited is the terminology, and that allows them to waive a number of different requirements.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, the ABAI, which is equivalent to or similar to the APA's role in kind of the psychology world, ABAI does accredit college programs. So I want to be very cautious of our language that the very verified course sequence and accredited programs are essentially two different things. So again, that takes me back to kind of what Dr. Davey and I were talking about. That takes me back to, I think that BACB approved program is still essentially saying the BACB approved this program to accept your certificate. Therefore, that could count as a BACB approved program. Because the verified course sequence to me is an like internal administrative kind of handing off the manpower to the professional association, but the BACB still has the ability to say this one doesn't meet those standards, or and they still have, I think, some say at the table with the verified course sequence requirements, especially since they are the bodies that hold the accreditation. So the BACB is accredited by another entity, and so as that accreditation says you need to change your coursework, then the BACB is going to have to go to ABAI and say, hey, per our accreditation, this is what the new standards have to be. So I still think the BACB is still the hub of that information. And the BACB is based on those reviews.
So you think we could keep BACB approved?
Now that I talked myself through all that, yes, I think that is the best option.
Go ahead, Dr. Davey.
I was just saying, I agree with that. I think it stays at the BACB level.
Do we need to also put in approved / verified? Would that help us or hurt us?
Mr. Chair, I think that would cause some confusion because the BACB is no longer verifying. And so if we put verified, then we'd have to bring in the entity that's verifying. Again, I think the way that I articulated in my head now, I should have done this way earlier, but the way that I articulated in my head is that, again, that accrediting body is connected to the BACB and not to ABAI. So all of those recommendations, like I said, it's kind of like in a medical home where the primary care physician is the hub, and then you've got specialty providers, nursing staff, all the other things. I think the BACB is kind of that hub. And I think the moment we start talking about the linguistics of their administrative process, we might get a little bit too confused or specific.
Okay. So if that's the case, then the only challenge before us on this particular issue is the grammar, right? The degree program in which the applicant completed a BACB-approved program. Is there another way to say that? Could we simply
double
say... I don't know why course sequence was deleted or replaced with program. What would happen if we just said, no, we want to keep that language, course sequence?
I don't read
something around.
Kathy?
Yes.
Were you... Or who is speaking?
I'm sorry, this is Kathy. What I'm looking at is I'm trying to determine how you're wanting this to, because you've got two different things going on in this number two. Is a an approved course sequence a degree program, or is it that the applicant completed a BACB approved program and take out a degree program altogether?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Volk, I like them.
Was that Dr. Ray?
I'm also looking at the newsletter that came out referencing some of this from the BACB, and they use the term BCBA eligible pathway or requirement. So I wonder if there's a way to get that language in, because it collectively describes sort of what's currently in place and what will be in place. So I wonder if that language might be useful in some way. Dr. Wright, my only concern with that is that eligible pathway, I believe, may also include the alternative options, and we don't recognize the alternative options. So like the option of having a doctoral degree with experience for 10 years, being able to sit for your exam, we don't recognize those options. So that would be my only, and I would have to look further into it, but that'd be my only concern, is that usually when I'm hearing them talk about eligible pathways, they're talking about the like option one and option two, and we only recognize option one because option two does not include the coursework that, or the, the coursework. Option two does not require the coursework at all. And if there's nothing in statute that prevents that, I think that, you know, could be an option in the rule change, but I just want to make sure that the statute doesn't reference coursework or anything of that nature, because that option two is an eligible pathway by the BACB, but it does not include coursework.
So I see what you're saying currently. I think in the future it will, but maybe we just reframe it around a degree program, which is like,
I love the language, by the way. I think that would have been a great solution.
Yeah, it's good language, and I think it does help moving forward where they do have the coursework incorporated, but to your point, at the moment, that language may not capture it correctly. Could it, a degree with meeting BCBA requirement? I don't know. That's a tricky one.
And just for my education, because it's been a while since I looked into this, but is number two in our stating, B2, to be licensed a behavior analyst in Arizona, individual shall have a master's degree or higher from an accredited institution in behavior analysis, education, psychology, or other subject related to behavior analysis acceptable to the board, or a degree program in which the applicant completed BACB approved course sequence. Is that number two stating that there is no room for a standalone certificate program? It's the degree program must include the course sequence, or?
Mr. Chair, that's what I like about what Ms. Bolt recommended, is just that we have in there that the applicant has completed a BACB approved program, because then it's not a question of was it the six course sequence. Under the new task list 5, there's actually 7 courses depending on allocation of courses. Some people are combining. There's some people that only did 5 courses. And so I think that if we were to take out a degree program entirely right there, because it's already talking about a master's degree or higher from an accredited institution,
And then what does the master's degree have to be? And then it could be and or maybe a BACB. Well, that I see what you're saying. So where it says or, so you have to have a degree in one of those areas. So it should be you have to have a degree in one of those areas and a BACB approved program, or a degree in a BACB approved degree program. So I get what you're saying there, that that's where the confusion is that you can have a degree and a certificate, which is not captured here, mm-hmm. in my opinion, or mm-hmm. you can have a degree program that you don't have to have the separate certificate for. Mm-hmm. So with that, I almost think that one would need to be changed to behavior analysis, behavior analysis, education, psychology, another subject area, blah, 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 and completed a BACB approved program. And option number two would be a BAC approved degree program.
And but the BACB approved degree program could fall under number one if we wrote number one slightly differently.
Yeah.
So we have. So what if we did that? What if we said a master's degree or higher from an accredited institution of higher education in behavior analysis, education, psychology, or other subject area, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, it's already covered, Dan. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Another subject area related to behavior analysis acceptable to the board. That, to me, kind of covers anything like a BACB degree program.
Yeah, but it says a degree, a master's degree. And so if the other subject area is the equivalent of a certificate program, so let's say somebody got a degree in education and a certificate program, that certificate is not a degree.
Correct. So, but Mr. Chair, I do think though that if we just switch the and instead of or, so it's not one or two, but it's one and two, and we just changed it to completed and approved BACB approved program, that's not really degree certificate specific.
So okay, so number two, we would just simply. It would simply read a BACB approved program.
Yep. Right. And the or would need to be removed because it needs to be both. You need to have one of these degrees and completed the program. And if your program happened to be all in one, then you meet that. But if your program happened mm-hmm. to be separated, then you still meet that as well. I don't know, mm-hmm. Ms. Galvin, if that is appropriate kind of interpretation.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Davis-Wilson, committee members, this is Kathy. I have a question about that. If then we have an applicant who has a degree in a master's degree in education, but did not take ABA courses, approved or behavior analysis courses, if you change the language to an and, would that not prevent that person from getting a behavior analyst license?
It would, and it should.
Okay.
So the degree in education is not sufficient. They need a degree in education and the behavior analytic courses.
Okay.
So this is looking good. We've got B1, behavior analysis, education, psychology, or other subject area related to behavior analysis acceptable to the board, and a BACB approved course sequence. And it could be embedded in their program. It could be separate from their program. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think so, Mr. Chair. I am looking real quick, though, at the education piece while we're on this, because to Dr. Reitz's point, they're getting ready to change mm-hmm. the degree types too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. Oh, you know what? It's in statute. Okay. So that's another one of those that, like I said, we can't really do much.
Oh, let me see. Maybe. I wonder, yeah, this Dr. Reid, that...
Oh, go ahead, Dr. Reid, sorry.
That's okay. Back to the language. I'm wondering if we want to think of saying something closer to and meet requirements by the BACB, some language, because again, I think the BACB approved might get us caught up over time. Because I think they're moving away in language from BACB approved, and so that might get us caught up. So maybe something more like meets the requirements laid out by the BACB or something like that, as opposed to BACB approved. It sounds more like a stamp mark, and I just am worried that as they move away to this ABAI approved, there could be some disconnects there. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Dr. Reitz, I agree. I guess my question, and it goes back to what I very first stated, is that a lot of what they're moving towards goes into effect 2022, and we've got statutory changes that we need to make at that time. And when you make statutory changes, and the board staff, please correct me if I'm wrong, I'm totally going off of historical knowledge, we do automatically have the opportunity to kind of make rule changes. So I'm wondering if we're already thinking statutory changes are going to need to be considered before 2022, if those little things will still have the opportunity to change by then. Just something to think about, just so that we're not being too specific to the 2022 changes, because now we're starting to get in a point where, at least for me, it's going back and forth between now checking statute. It used to be that as the BACB made changes, they were small enough to know that they were made at a rule level as it translates to what we did. But the more that I see the changes that they have coming out, the more some of the statutory language needs to possibly be considered. And so that's just a point, like, I think that we are also going to have time to really clean up some of that as they make these changes.
And Dr. Davis Wilson, you are correct that if there's a statutory change, then the rule change would follow. And something to think about when you make that statutory change, some agencies will get an exemption from the rulemaking process that would allow you to make the statutory changes, and then any rule changes that follow, get something put in session law that would allow you to make those rule changes without going through the formal rulemaking process. You could still hear from stakeholders, but you don't have all the publishing deadlines and everything else, and it could speed it along.
But until that time, I like what Dr. Reitz was saying in terms of keeping the language broad enough but also implying that it's acceptable to the BACB or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. So can we finish this up? B1 and 2. B1 says behavior analysis, education, psychology, or another subject area related to behavior analysis acceptable to the board, and 2, an approved course sequence acceptable to the BACB?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you were saying, Dr. Reitz?
A program that meets the requirements as defined by the BACB, something like that.
Mm-hmm. That would be fine with me. committee members, are we okay with that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I do have one additional comment, but I was trying to look up. I thought it was in statute, but it is not. So one other just point, and again, I don't know that it totally matters because it's not a change for the BACB until 2022, but I am looking at the statute, and education does not define the degree type in the statute. And so one thing that I would make to point number one is that, you know, we originally had it written like that because that was the language of the board or of the, that was the language of the BACB, but the BACB is changing their language to say any master's degree in higher education. And so I just want to point that out, that I thought that was maybe in statute. It is not. It is only in rule. So I don't know if you guys want to consider making that change now or making it after. The statute section that I was referring to is the education and qualifications. And it does list the different field work types that will no longer be around in 2022, except for like historic information. And so again, we're going to have to look at the statutory language, but in this particular case, the degree type is not defined in statute. So I don't know if you guys want to take a stab at that or just wait until we do the other work towards 2022.
If it's a simple fix, I'm in favor of fixing it now. To not tie our hands to something. So if we were to change B1 to behavior analysis, a master's degree or higher from an accredited institution of higher education in behavior analysis or any subject area related to behavior analysis acceptable to the board. And two, go ahead.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, we could do away with one and two and just make it a single sentence because it already says to be licensed as behavior analyst in Arizona, an individual shall have a master's degree or higher from an accredited institute of higher education. That is exactly the verbiage that BACB is going forward with. And so then we would say and then put in the language that you and Dr. Rates so we could actually take out the one and two and just have higher education and that statement of the
Dr. Rates, do you remember what you said?
let's see. Program meets the requirements as defined by the BACB.
Okay. So then we would just be take out, scratch one and two altogether, and it would say to be licensed as a behavior analyst in Arizona, an individual shall have a master's degree or higher from an accredited institution of higher education and have completed a
program requirement as defined by the BACB.
Yep.
Whew. That was a team effort.
Looks good, though.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is Kathy. Could I just read that back to you to make sure I've written it down correctly?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. To be licensed as a behavior analyst in Arizona, an individual shall have a master's degree. Master's degree or higher from an accredited institution of higher education and completed a program that meets requirements as defined by the BACB. Is that correct?
I think it sounds good.
Mm-hmm. All
right, thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
I apologize for the maze that I took us on to get there, but sounds great.
All right. Then the next item I see is top of page 2 in the memo, R4-26-6 ethical standard. So it's the January 1, 2016 that was... It's at issue.
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes.
So our recommendation under this standard was to try to draft language. So our recommendation to the rule writer was to draft language that would allow us to enforce whatever current published one is available. So right now, January 1st, 2016 is the current, but if it were to change in, 2020, we would want to not have two sets of standards where some people are, doing the old and the new. And this is particularly important when it comes to, coursework and training supervisees, because mm-hmm. if there are changes that, require coursework changes, what ends up happening is, for example, at ASU, we would have to have kind of this dual language going on to teach the Arizona local ethics course to make sure they understand, hey, you have to know the outdated one that is no longer in place by the mm-hmm. certification board and the new one. And so we were hoping to find language that would allow us to adopt the current version of that. One thing that I will say, speaking a little bit more on behalf of historical board stance, is that when we did, and I say prior to me being on the board, but just the stance that some of the board members had presented before, when we did adopt this particular dated one, the full board went through and reviewed and approved that dated one. So there is that caveat that the board may be uncomfortable with kind of too general language that would require them to, potentially be an acceptance of a change in ethics that goes against what the board stands for public protection. So I think one thing we may want to consider is in drafting a little bit of the language of it can be the most current, or it can be this one or one approved by the board, so that the board has the authority if all of a sudden the BACB for some reason were to go out and loosen the requirements to that of which is less than the January 2016, that the board would be able to say no, we need the January 2016 one. So that'd be the only piece that I would throw out there as a consideration for getting this language passed by the board, is to just keep in mind that we don't want, and we don't expect it, but if it were to happen, we don't want the requirement to loosen and the board be stuck in a funky position because the requirements are too loose and do not protect the public.
So could we state, thank you for that, that helped. Could we state the board incorporates by reference the BACB professional and ethical compliance code for behavior analysts, or we could say the most current BACB, blah, 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 and approved by the board.
Yes.
And then this is available at the BA for review at the published by the BACB and available for review at the board office.
This is Jean Galvin. If you have a rule that says that the board incorporates by reference, rule writing requirements provide that you have to state a date of the material that you are incorporating by reference. So there's no question about what version of the document that you are incorporating. Some boards have gone to a statute that says the board, as its ethical guidelines, adopts the most recent version by whatever organization, and that's typically in statute, and they use the word adopts rather than incorporates by reference. But
and we could talk to Jeannie Hahn about this, but just saying that you incorporate by reference the most recent version is probably going to get kicked back by the Governor's Regulatory Review Council.
But if we said adopt by reference, would that make any difference?
You could just say that the board adopts, not incorporates by reference, but adopts the most recent version of the BACB ethical principles. Like I said, that's often in statute and not in rule. But Ms. Han might be able to offer you, you know, curtain guidance on that. And you can say something along the lines that you would adopt the most current, you know, version of the ethical principles unless the board otherwise, you know, so states. So that would get to Ms. or Dr. Davis-Wilson's concern that if for some reason that no one foresees right now, the ethical principles are loosened and the board would not approve them, that rule would give the board an option to opt out of the adoption of the most recent ethical principles.
I'd like to try for that as one committee member.
But I think if you know you generally tell staff what your concerns are, then they can work with Ms. Han to, because I think with all of these changes, it's going to have to come back to you guys and the board to ensure that staff has, you know, captured everything that you are dictating right now or suggesting, and then we can get guidance from Ms. Han about that language. Communicating to her what your desire is, not having to revise the rule every time the BACB comes out with new ethical principles, and giving the board a way out if they don't care for the ethical principles that have been adopted.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Galvin, I'm trying to look in statute right now, and I'm not finding anything for behavior analysts. I do see in the psychologist statute that it does reference the establishment or adopting of a code of ethics that meets the APA requirements. But I'm not seeing anything right now in statute, which is fine. I'm just trying to figure out, because I agree, it would be nice to have it in statute, and then if needed, it could be clarified in rule, which again would be a different piece, but we still need, the thing with ethics, just to give kind of the BACB side, is like historically they haven't had like a lot of planning for changes in ethics. It's not like these other large changes. It's more of like, oh, guess what, January 1st, 2019. And so, I think that's the part that worries me about having the January 1st, 2016. So I hear what you're saying, and I agree that we can add it to kind of our notes for statutes, because I'm not seeing anything in there that's statutory related to our ethics. But that could be me overlooking it. It's a big document. But I still am like, do you have a way, or do we take it back to Ms. Han and say this is kind of where our concern is, while also recognizing that this would also probably need to be considered for a more standard process of having it in statute?
And we can talk to Ms. Han and see if we can do something about the board adopts the most recent version of the BACB's ethical principles and guidelines, unless the board, you know, votes at a regular meeting to note exceptions to the most current version of the ethical principles and guidelines. So
I like that.
I think there's a way to do that without incorporating by reference, where you have to have the specific date. And that's required by the Secretary of State. It's nothing, it's something you can't get around. GIRC will kick it back, like I said.
So I'm in favor of going back to Ms. Han and asking, and with language that says the board adopts, and then see what where she goes with that.
Right, and that staff is good with that.
And there would be no date incorporated into that language. Any other concerns from other committee members or staff? Kathy, are you okay with this?
I did have a question. Sorry, my mic was muted. Mr. Chairman, make sure I understand correctly that you're not going to make any changes right now to the way the rule is written right this second. We're going to go back to, the staff is going to go back and talk to Ms. Hahn and possibly strike the entire language regarding incorporation by reference and the date.
And the date. I think it would be easiest if we gave Ms. Hahn language that we're recommending to give her to work from. So if I heard everybody correctly, we would say the board adopts the BACB Professional and Ethical Compliance Code for Behavior Analysts and published by the BACB and available for review at the board office online. And that's it. And then let Ms. Hahn correct or edit as needed.
And then we'll
basically, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, and then we'll, once we receive Ms. Hahn's recommendations, we will need to bring it back to the committee and the mm-hmm. board.
So. Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Any further discussion about 26406? Hearing none. Supervisor experience verification, 26403, 26404. This is the second half, the last part of page 2. And rules in conflict. Applicants shall ensure that the following is submitted directly to the board. Verification of supervisor experience that meets standards specified in 404.2. Documentation of supervision, if the board determines supervision is needed to enable it to assess applicant qualification, the applicant shall submit documentation of hours supervisor experience when requested. The board shall accept for purpose of license a copy of the BACB verification form submitted by. I don't need to read this for you. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes, please.
Okay. So, and I'm going to, again, kind of give intent from the rule writing perspective and what was presented to the full board at the time that this was kind of developed just for that historical piece. But essentially, what was presented as a concern early on before we even had the committee was still this idea that people could have a form from the BACB or from the psychology board application filled out by a supervisor knowledgeable of an experience, but not necessarily be the supervisor that did the direct work. Now, one of the things that we were talking about, and we were talking about it in light of how do we reduce duplication in this process, was that rather than having to submit a separate form from the APBE, from anybody, that they could provide us copies of what they submitted to the BACB. Now, from the way that it reads is that it looks like, so we've got the first section, which is the section that talks about what's required from documentation to apply for initial license. The second section that she's referring to, that's R4-26-404.2C72, that is actually, in my interpretation, referring to if we need additional information. And so I think that, the intent was to reduce the duplication of having a supervisor fill out a separate form when they already filled out one form. It was also to disincentivize having a supervisor who knew the supervisee from signing the full form, because then if they could just send us the 8, 9, 10
BACB experience verification forms, then we would be able to say, like, yes, they, you know, they met these requirements or whatever, per the BACB and move forward. That was the intent. I could go back and look at which board meeting, Ms. Olvey and I, or Dr. Olvey and I actually presented that to, the board. It was a telephonic, Dr. Wexler was probably, the one that, was a little bit on the fence, but then immediately said, yes, this makes sense. But then I see now how they're conflicting and didn't meet that intent. So, but I wanted to give that historical perspective of, again, we have one side that says, hey, we need first party verification on supervision standards, which is oftentimes done through the supervisor filling out the psychology board, version. And then the other section actually is intended to be if we have continued questions about the applicant that requires us to assess their supervision program, then that's when we would start to request those other bits of information. And so I think there was some confusion, and so the board staff has been looking for some direction on that, and I think it really needs to be clarified in the rules. But I'll turn it over to board staff for them to add their viewpoint. I just wanted to throw out there kind of the history of what happened and the conversation that Dr. Olvey and I had with the school board back, gosh, long before the committee was created. So probably 2015, 2016, maybe even 2017. But that's my overview.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is Kathy. When this rule went into effect, December 12, 2018, I saw it as, from my licensing experience, both with this board and another board, primary source verification of training needs to come directly from the supervisor in order for it to be true primary source. A single copy from the applicant does not meet that standard. And so I had, in order to comply with R-426-403-C2, I was having the applicants either send the psychologist examiner's supervised experience form, or they could have their supervisors send the BACB experience verification forms in lieu of our form. And so then the only time I was accepting the BACB experience verification forms not from the supervisor but from the applicant was only under certain circumstances. It's if the applicant said the supervisor could not be located and gave me a legitimate description of that, and I couldn't find that supervisor on the BACB's registry, because you can often contact them through the registry if there's an email address available, but when they aren't there and they're no longer certified, I accepted the applicant's statement and then accepted the BACB experience verification forms at that point from the applicant. Other times, as you have noted, I'm sure many times, our supervised experience and or independent fieldwork verification form was problematic. We were finding the supervisor wasn't licensed in Arizona, but the experience took place, you know, the remote supervision issues. And so then I was allowing them to send them in ahead of time to try to avoid another fare letter and delays in the application process. So you were seeing the experience verification form, you were noting it was problematic, but then you were seeing the supervised experience verification forms from the BACB in the file. And then the other time was when in meeting you did direct me to obtain the BACB experience verification forms.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Ms. Fultz, I'm going to semi-speak on behalf of the committee, but it is coming from me, as the work that you have done has been extremely, extremely beneficial in our process. So my question for you would be, should we modify the language to kind of clean up so that it aligns with what you're currently doing? Like, what do you need from us as a committee to help support you? Because the way you just described it, I think, is exactly what the intent would be.
I agree that that primary source verification piece, I call it first party, sorry, primary source verification has been a important factor of even some of the board conversations relating to other things. So I agree with your thought process in that. But how do you propose we clean up that language? Because I personally feel like this is more of language that does direct you guys as board staff. So I think it's important that your kind of language or voice is kind of being heard in this section, because as far as what I've seen, like, our application reviews have been incredible. You've done a great job in interpreting kind of our perspective. And so what would be your proposal that we do with this section?
Board staff, Dr. Davis-Wilson, I'm sorry, not board staff, Mr. Chairman, sorry. I would hope Jean would jump in, because I, not being an attorney, I don't know for sure how much information should be in the rules, or if it should be a policy, or if it's just direction that we have in the minutes so that I have it. But I one of the reasons I put that in the memo was to give, if this was how you wanted me to handle it, to give you the step-by-step, if it was supposed to go in rule. This is where I feel like I don't have the background to give that advice.
What should be in rule is what is required of an applicant. How you process that information or what you do with that information is what would be in policy. So if it would be helpful for your process, but also to educate an applicant what is required and when, then it should be in rule. I don't know if that's helpful or not, but from what Dr. Davis-Wilson is saying, it would appear that the two sections may not be clear as to in what stage of the process is a certain form required or primary source verification. So she's looking to you, based on the process that you've developed and what you require of applicants, could those two sections be clarified in any way? And maybe you need some more time now that you can understand what Dr. Davis-Wilson is saying and how you process things, maybe to work something out with Ms. Hahn in helping her understand what those two sections are for and how best to revise them so it reflects what you do in the office in, you know, real time and what is required by an applicant.
I think, this is Kathy again, under R4-26-403C2, where it says, additionally, an applicant shall ensure that the following, and then two, verification of supervised experience, could we do two sub rules there that explain which two types of verifications we can accept, you know, an either and or, either our form, the board's form, or the BACB verification forms, experience verification forms, and that way the applicant knows it's an either or, but it must come from the supervisor first.
Yes, you could.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Galvin, Ms. Folks, one question I would have from that, like, I'm still not sure that same section you're referencing really explains to the applicant that it's primary source verification. And so I don't know if we want to put language to make sure that it's from the supervisor in both of those sections. So here's the forms we accept directly from the supervisor, because that's the piece I think that people have gotten hung up on the BACB forms specifically, is that they're not necessarily coming from the supervisor. So I don't know if that's an applicant guidance piece but anything that we can do. And I'm with Ms. Galvin. Ms. Hahn may have some suggestions on how we make that very clear. So I agree, Ms. Folks, with what you're saying, and then just make sure that it's clear that it has to be that primary source, because I'm not sure everybody's understanding that.
And Kathy suggests maybe that comes directly from the supervisor, directly to the board, but we can clarify that, because you're correct, it would help the applicants.
And, sorry, Mr. Chair, Ms. Galvin, could we also take and kind of have like an exemption section or something right there that would clarify like what happens, because
I appreciate all of the work, but we don't have anywhere in rule that says if you can't produce this, then the applicant can state the supervisor cannot be located. Then the applicant, you know what I mean? And so should we make sure that that's in there as well? Well, I guess under which conditions an applicant can send those forms, I do think that would probably provide clarification as well. And I do think it would be two parts. So I think if you look on the page of the memo where it talks about Ms. Folks' process, I think number one, applicant says the supervisor cannot be located, would fall under 403C2. But two and three fall under 404.2C72, and I think are already identified there. So I think that those are, because remember the R4-26-404.2C72 is stating that if we need additional information, whether it be that we need to assess further parts of supervision or we're requesting the form, that actually covers that section. The one piece that I'm not seeing in rule is that number one, the applicant stated that the supervisor could not be located, and I wonder if that needs to be in R4-26-403C2.
I think that we can, working with Ms. Tan, provide guidance to an applicant when the supervisor is not available or in other circumstances that don't fit in the other section about providing primary source verification without putting it in policy. You can set forth additional circumstances when the applicant would be required to submit additional information. I think that can be drafted.
Okay.
And since this is going to come back to us, I would ask board staff to go ahead and draft that. And ask now if you have any questions about the intent of the language. But I'm with Dr. Davis Wilson. The work you've done, Kathy, has been phenomenal. And if you understand the intent behind this, then I, for one, certainly would trust what you draft and what Ms. Galvin reviews.
You clear?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. She says that she understands the intent, and if there's any follow-up, if it would be okay if we contacted Dr. Davis Wilson to ensure that we've captured her suggestions.
That would be fine with me. Other committee members?
I think that sounds great.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Thank you. Was there anything else on this particular supervised experience verification issue? Hearing none, I think Dr. Davis Wilson indicated that since we are trying to include other changes in rules with this one fell swoop, if you will. I think Dr. Davis Wilson had some that she wanted to mention, and I have a couple myself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My biggest point, I think, do need to be addressed in statute. So again, it's one of those that we can't really make the revisions until we change the statute. But specifically around the supervision in the statute is that one, the 1500 hours is not that big of a deal because they're moving forward with 1500 hours at the board level. It was something that was brought up at the sunset audit as being a little bit prescriptive on behalf of the board. But if anybody is familiar with the conversations we've had with the board around those hours, we have not had a ton of success in kind of articulating, including our own field, not having the data to present to the board. so we haven't had a lot of success in articulating it. However, it does in that section of the statute define intensive practicum, and supervised field work. And so then that trickles down into the requirements and rule. And because that language is changing, I do think that we need to take at least that prescriptiveness out of the statute, not necessarily the numbers per se, but definitely the definitions of types of supervision, so that then we can define them in rules so that they can kind of evolve with the changes that are occurring. All the changes are positive, as we're aware. The minimum for the BACB is now going to 1,500, with the other program being at 2,000. So I think that it's just a matter of not being so prescriptive in how we define the supervision programs. But those sections of the rules, because they do tie to statute, I'm not sure we can make any changes at this point, or that we should at this point.
Okay. Are there changes in rules that are not defined in statute that you would like to include with this packet going back to Ms. Hahn?
No, I am open for discussion on it. I think we've looked at this so many times that I would appreciate your guys' thoughts on it.
There were a couple of notes that I made from recent, not recent, but past discussions we had about the rules, and these are, could be relatively simple fixes. But one is in supervised experience requirement. That would be 404.2. Supervised experience requirement. And then it's under supervised experience requirement C, standards for supervised experience. And number 5, the nature of supervision. So this would be on page, of our rules. And then it is 5A, effective supervision includes, and then it's item number 2, Roman numeral 2, II. The nature of supervision 5A, effective supervision includes, II, observing the supervisee and providing performance feedback on behavior analytic activities with clients in the natural environment. In-person, on-site observation is preferred, but use of web cameras, videotape, I think we had discussed changing that to video recording because it's more generic and nobody uses videotape anymore. So video recording, video conferencing, or other means that provide synchronous and asynchronous, or synchronous or asynchronous observation is acceptable. Does that ring a bell for other committee members? Do you remember that conversation?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I remember that conversation.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is Kathy. My understanding is those changes have been made. We did not give those changes to you. Because that one was not in question. It was clear and has been added to the rules package.
Okay. So it's not listed in the current rules except in 12-12-2018. But it is included in the package that is going to Ms. Hahn?
That is correct.
Okay. There was another request that I have, and this is in the spirit of trying to write rules that don't have to be changed every time. It's similar to the ethical code. Which version of the ethical code is the board adopting? And it is R426405 coursework requirement. And it is letter B, capital B, to be licensed as a behavior analyst. And this is the bottom of page 11 of the approved rules. To be licensed behavior analyst in Arizona, an individual shall complete as part of or in addition to the coursework necessary to obtain a graduate degree, classroom hours of graduate level instruction. The individual shall ensure that the classroom hours include the following content areas. And then they break this down into, you know, ethical, professional, 45 hours, et cetera, et cetera. And it's been my past experience as somebody who was responsible for the university coursework that each time the BACD amended these, and let's say we went from 180 hours to 225 hours, now 270 hours in the future, we have to revise all of these breakdowns. And I would just, fingers crossed, hope that we could get an approved that says, the last sentence of letter B says the individual shall ensure that the classroom hours meet the requirements as the current requirements as defined by the BACB and approved by the board, or something, some language like that that would allow us greater flexibility to be nimble and adjust our requirements upward without always having to get rules changed to do that. It would be board approval. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, this is Dr. Davis Wilson. I agree with that, and I think the biggest problem is the allocation of the hours. I mean, one could argue because the requirement changing to 315 instead of 270, one could argue that, well, it meets at least 270, so that's fine. The issue is that the allocation of the hours are also changing. And so where right. each hour falls, and what that's going to do is create a huge administrative burden for us, plus potentially restrict people who are in that funky task list 4, task list 5 transition, because we're going to have to go through and pull syllabi or look at transcripts and say, well, do you meet the new coursework allocation? And so I agree that bottom half is extremely problematic with the upcoming changes. And just to give, again, because I'm full of lots of words, okay? To give a historical perspective is in the past, that's why we have that this excludes before January 1st, 2015, because that allowed for us to not have to kind of look at everybody's transcripts, because everybody beyond that point would be under the new standards. And so the problem now is that we either have to continue to keep changing that date. So now it might be, you know, anybody that's licensed before January 1st, 2022 instead of January 1st, 2015. So it's either going to require us to keep changing that date or kind of have the language that is more broad that says, hey, you meet the requirements at the time that you did your coursework and were eligible by the BACB standards.
Thank you. So, Ms. Galvin, can you foresee a problem trying to change the rules accordingly?
I do. With the upcoming changes, I do appreciate Dr. Davis Wilson's suggestion about inserting a date, but then that's going to require you to go back when the changes come again. But what we've done earlier, and we spoke about earlier,
if we talk to Ms. Hahn about this and talk to her about not only the hours changing but the allocation, and then we have dates, she might be able to come up with something that would draft our way around this. But unfortunately, there are circumstances where you do have to go back in and amend the rules because of these changing standards. And that's, you know, unfortunate, but sometimes you are left with no other option. We may have to revert back to a date certain.
No, I understand that, and we've lived with that all this time.
Right.
And it would be much easier if the BACB were to change all of their requirements, from ethical standards to provision standards to coursework standards, all at the same time. But their history has not been that. And so we end up with changes in one area that are not always and older requirements that have not yet been changed. And so it's just, again, it's just about being nimble and being able to, with board approval rather than rules changes, try to do as much as we can.
And perhaps as you know, licensure comes on board in more states, and states have gone through, you know, a number of iterations with all of these standards, you know, BACB will come to the point where there won't be as many frequent changes, that everything will become more uniform and more stable.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Galvin, so I'm wondering if, and I know this isn't ideal to what you're suggesting, Dr. Davidson, but I do think that if there was a way to change that January 1st, 2015 to 2022, make B align with the 2022 changes, I mean, that would buy us quite a bit of time, because that other way bought us 7 years, you know, essentially 7 years of good rule. And even though we didn't have the rules finished in the timely fashion that we had hoped for, I still think that, one, we're still in alignment with our goal of meeting that of the BACB. Two, it's comforting for the full board to understand that the standards, if they were to change tomorrow, aren't going to immediately affect protecting the public. But I really do, you know, we know that the BACB undergoes the audit, what, every 5 years, 4 years? And then we know that these changes are a five-year cycle. So 5 to 7 years, to me, is a really good, lengthy time to have rule. But maybe I'm misinterpreting that, but that's how that I would be okay in helping Ms. Hahn kind of develop that. And I know Dr. David said it doesn't meet what you're looking for, but I do think that it would provide the clarification and comfort to everybody else.
How would that work with if we changed 2015 to 2022, but we didn't change B below? Would there be a disconnect? Is there a possible inconsistency?
We would need to change B to meet the coursework allocation of the 315 hours and how it would be allocated. Because if we don't change B, then we've got just the 270 hours, which is fine because it's 315. But I don't have, and maybe Dr. Stenhoff has a quick reference for it, but I want to say just at glance alone, the very last allocation about supervision, implement, oversight, that sort of thing, I think that's jumping up to like 40 hours or something. If we don't fix those allocations, I think it might put kind of the due diligence on the board to have to check transcripts. And I don't know that that's productive or effective.
So we list a higher breakdown of an allocation, but we list the January 2022 date. And that allows people currently, with the current breakdown, to be approved at any time prior to January 2022.
Even beyond that, if they move...
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean.
Now,
yeah.
So that doesn't matter. But let's say that someone isn't
they did the current coursework, but they're not testing until, you know, then, or they don't pass their test and they retest, we would still be able to say they met the requirements prior. They were certified but not licensed yet. We could still say they met the requirements prior to that date.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were certified, it's certification, not just testing, but they were certified prior to that date. So it goes back, like, in most of the reasons why we did that is to incentivize people moving out here, because we were concerned that by having the new standards, people would look at it and not move out. But then if they tested and they're moving from, let's say they're moving from California, which is a non-licensure, they wouldn't fall under universal recognition. So if they're moving from California out here and they, you know, fell under the old standards, we want that January 1st, 2022 as an exemption for them, because they met the standards. They've been working in California for 6 years, but they don't have licensure to come over under universal recognition. So it would allow for us to not restrict out-of-state BCBAs from coming to the state, but okay, still capture the new standards.
Ms. Galvin, your thoughts?
I agree with Dr. Davis-Wilson, and am confident that we can address it through rule.
Excellent. Thank you. Those are the only other changes I wanted to, that I noted, that I'd like to see changed in the rule.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is Kathy. I had a question about R4-26-407, licensed by reciprocity. Is there any purpose to that rule?
It's a good question. I've not seen any purpose to having that since our past response to has always been, well, you're free to apply to license like anyone else in our state. There has been no reciprocity up to this point.
Mr. Chair, I agree. So, Ms. Galvin, does it need to be in it? Because it is kind of funny saying licensed by reciprocity, just kidding.
Could you repeat your last statement?
I said it kind of reads licensed by reciprocity, just kidding, because it's basically saying, like, you can apply, but it's not really by reciprocity. They still have to meet all of the standards of initial licensure. So it's kind of just a funky thing to say, oh, you know, here's licensed by reciprocity. By the way, it's like equivalent to that. Should we have, or should that be licensed by universal recognition and we add in that information, or no?
Now, there are two separate methods by which you can become licensed, but you're essentially in 407 repeating what the standard requirements are.
Correct. And so the question that I would have with that is, could we remove that and add something related to the other process by which someone could get licensed?
I don't.
Because that's not in rule, right?
It is not in rule. I don't see the need for 407. If you're going to have reciprocity, this isn't truly reciprocity, 407. So if you want to offer licensure by reciprocity, you would have to change the requirements and, you know, whatever you want to change them to, not just repeat what is required by regular licensure. I don't know if you need a rule for universal acceptance, universal recognition. It's fairly straightforward, but you could, you know, maybe take some of the documentation requirements that we put in a substantive policy statement. You could put those in a rule. I don't know of other agencies that have talked about starting the rulemaking process for universal recognition. I just don't know if you need it.
Ms. Gal?
Yes.
Yeah. I would say, Ms. Galvin, you know, my only thought as to why we would consider it is because, or why I think, you know, we should have a discussion around it is because for so long it wasn't a thing, and I'm not sure that people are going to be easily educated on the process if it's not. Like, I get that it's a statute, so we have to kind of abide by it, but there are still off, like, board member processes around it. And then if applicants are moving into state, like, if they're not familiar with the statute or what have you, I mean, I don't care either way, but I think that it could provide guidance to applicants, as well as help support, some of the decision making when it comes to reviewing applicants that are universal recognition. I agree. I don't know that it's totally needed, but I wouldn't be opposed to a conversation around whether it would be helpful.
And that's certainly something that we could put on a future agenda and have that discussion. Nothing that would prohibit you from having that discussion and or moving forward with rulemaking.
It would just be nice. Go ahead, Dr. Davis.
I was just going to say maybe it's something that we add to our list of things that we'd want to consider when we do the rule or the statutory stuff.
If it's not, I mean, we have a mandate for licensed by universal recognition, and we have no process for licensed by reciprocity. If we're going to look at our rules document as a way to guide us and any applicant who wants to view the rules, it would be nice if the relevant procedures were included here. So in this case, as of today, there is no license by reciprocity, and there is a license by universal recognition. So I would like to see our rules incorporate that at some point, but it doesn't have to, in my opinion, it doesn't have to be today.
And we can discuss it because universal recognition rule is not really on the agenda, but we can put it on a future agenda so you can discuss it, see if it would be helpful. Talk to Ms. Hahn. Like I said, I don't know if she's working with other agencies that are adopting rules.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is Kathy again. If the license by reciprocity rule has no purpose, did the committee want to remove it?
I think it's unnecessary. There really is not reciprocity. It's confusing.
I would agree.
So, other committee members?
I agree. I think it should go.
Okay, so we'll ask Ms. Hahn to remove it, and then the board is, the committee is, you know, recommending that licensure by reciprocity not be an avenue by which someone could get licensed.
Well, I agree. It has not been, as those rules are. All right. So thank you. Any other discussion on this item number 9, the rule? All right. Thank you. Item 10, new agenda items for future meetings. We have one, license by universal recognition to be included in the rules, possibly.
Mr. Chair, I've got two for you.
Okay.
One, I think, would be dependent on maybe Ms. Galvin's feedback as to whether it's the next agenda or another. But opening kind of the statutory packet and stuff, if I understand that correct, to work on statute, that costs the board money.
And so I just want to be cognizant that if the psychologists also have things that they're going to have to open up for statutory changes, if we could consider talking about how we can piggyback to that, of what additional changes we would like to propose so that we're not a year. I know the many of the changes going to affect 2022, but I don't want to be in a position where we're costing additional money to make those changes if they're already going to be opening that. And if they are, what month does that happen? Because we probably need to have that conversation soon.
Okay, and we can discuss that. I'm not aware of pending statutory changes except those related to the Auditor General's report that we'll have to have this next session, but that may be too early for your 2022 changes. But we will put it on a future agenda, and that's something that we'll, you know, keep tabs on. And we can get assistance through the board's, you know, rules and legislative committee as well.
Perfect. And that would be extremely helpful, because while the changes are 2022, the changes also align with the sunset audit recommendation. And so I think that there's good reason as to why to do that. But the other thing is that, you know, it took us 4 years to get these rules out. And so what I don't want is it 2022 to hit and we haven't been able to make it through the process. And so I'm confident that the changes that I at least have in mind for 2022 would not be negatively impacted one way or another if we do that rule or if we do that statute stuff early. I was just hoping to piggyback it more with other work that's being done, just because then we don't have to worry about it. They're pretty general. They align with the sunset audit recommendations, and we could get it done and over with and start working on kind of the rules for what it's going to look like for 2022.
And then as a board member, you can bring that up at a board meeting, maybe request through staff that it be placed on the October agenda or the September agenda. Because we are going to have to go to the legislature this session, is my understanding. So you may want to consider, drafting legislation this session, this upcoming session, rather than waiting for, 2021.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, would you guys be okay? I propose the October board meeting because that one's in person, right? And I know the phone ones can kind of get long. I'm not sure how long we're going to be on the phone this week, but maybe the October agenda, if that gives us enough time, and you guys as a committee. And that would also give the committee the chance for you guys to put together your thoughts and feedback so that I can include that to the board. But I would be happy to present that to the board if you guys are in agreement.
And maybe this is something that you can speak with staff to directly. It looks like October is probably going to, that October in-person meeting will also entail executive director interviews. And I think just to bring it up to the board, the need to have a statutory change, it would probably have to go to their legislative committee anyway. And so I don't know how much in-depth discussion that there would be, but just to get it on their radar, September might be appropriate.
And this is Jennifer. I do think September would be better. It's actually a pretty short agenda, so I think it would work better.
Perfect. Then, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if you guys want to get your thoughts over to Ms. Michelson between now and Thursday evening, maybe Ms. Michelson can send me over what you guys would like to make sure is included, and I would be happy to represent it on Friday at the meeting.
Thank you. So before, give them to Ms. Michelson before when?
By Thursday, so that she can compile the information or forward it along to me, because I'm correct in saying that they shouldn't be sending it to me directly, right?
Correct. It should go through Ms. Michelson. And it doesn't have to be, I mean, these can just be little bullet points. Just
email.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be an in-depth analysis of what you need and why.
Okay.
And it's just on the statutory stuff. Like I said, supervision is one that I see, and I'll go back and glance too. But those, I'm happy to do that the next full board meeting.
Not to say that it won't also be on the October agenda, but just to get it before them, I think it's good to introduce it in September.
Absolutely.
Okay. Was there anything else on this item?
I have one more, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So I was at a professional conference and had a couple of people, mention to me that they're getting remote supervision. I'm seeing this as a huge, huge increase as a problem. Essentially, we've seen, 3 applicants over the last 4 months that have been in this position. And we have, like I said, I'm hearing more of it. And when I asked one which program they're going through, it sounds like there's a couple of universities that are doing practicum programs unaware that their university supervisors that they're appointing need to be licensed in Arizona. So I don't know what can come of that or what we can do, but I do foresee this as being a large problem, both in having people who are, in essence, practicing without a license and then having supervisees who are unaware that their hours are not going to count. I had two of the individuals were crying, and it was not a board conversation by any means. They had came up to me after a presentation, and they were just so proud and excited about where they're doing their supervision program. I was like, that's great. And I said, just, make sure you're in alignment with all the current state-specific stuff and referred them back to the board. So board staff, you may get phone calls because I did not discuss anything with them but referred them back to you. It's becoming a pretty prevalent problem, and I'd like to have discussion around it.
Makes sense. Okay. Any other agenda items for future meetings? All right. Hearing none, can I have a motion to adjourn?
I motion we adjourn.
And a second?
I'll second.
I'll second.
Okay. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. We are adjourned. Thank you all very much. This is a good, very long, but productive.